WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Death is one of the few remaining taboos in this country. Many people die without wills. Few have written advance directives detailing the heroic measures they do or do not want use when they are near death. And we have a medical system that has invested heavily in technology to prolong life at great cost. Daniel Callahan is director of the Hastings Center and a leading medical ethicist. He says we have made death the enemy, and that makes us different from most other countries. It also makes our healthcare system the most expensive in the world. In his new book, The Troubled Dream of Life, Callahan argues that it's time to talk frankly about dying. A public debate about the quality of death, Callahan says, will have great cultural and psychological payoffs. In our discussion today about death, I began with the story of Amy and Angela Lakeberg, the conjoined twins who were just surgically separated. Amy died during the operation, and Angela is given only a slim chance of surviving. As a policy, Callahan has advocated the rationing of health care. I wanted to know what he thought of this case.
I have indeed argued for rationing, but really rationing is part of a national health care scheme and plan, not a kind of ad hoc rationing at the bedside. This was surely a very expensive experimental operation. The bill will go not only as high now, but it's going to go on for months and months. I think we ought to do this kind of thing, even if one can think of better ways to spend the money, perhaps better ways of saving other lives, if only because we don't have a rational healthcare system. We should not put doctors in the position of making sort of ad hoc decisions case by case as to whether the country can afford to pay for this. So in general, I suppose one's attitude, I think at this point, has to be, is this an operation likely to benefit the person who is going to be the beneficiary if things work out well?
What does the price tag for this operation, what issues does that raise for you?
Well, to me, the fundamental issue is how do we set priorities in this country? We know that there are a large number of children who don't get immunization, a common example. We've just passed a bill. We've seen a bill passed to take care of that. We know there are plenty of children that don't get primary care. We know that there are even children who are malnourished in this country. I suppose the fundamental question is how in the world do you justify spending hundreds of thousands of dollars to save the life in a rather extraordinary, rare kind of medical event versus taking the same amount of money and spending it in ways that might help hundreds or even thousands of other children. I think part of our problem in this country is we're addicted to technology. We're addicted to a kind of gambling to save life. And this is wonderful. There's a kind of romance about that, and indeed lives are saved. The price, however, is that we often neglect, overlook those very simple things that could probably save a lot more lives in the long run than these high technology ventures.
My guest is Daniel Callahan. He's the director and co-founder of the Hastings Center and a widely quoted expert on the issue of ethics and medicine and the author of a new book called The Troubled Dream of Life. Let's talk, if we can, about some of the ideas in your new book. And one of the things you argue for is a new or a common meaning of death. And I'm curious, as a man who I assume is in his middle age, how much do you think about your own death?
Well, I don't think about it on a daily basis. I suppose I think about it, first of all, when I read the obituary page and I see people I know or people I've perhaps simply people at a distance that I admire that have died. And then I say, my gosh, one of these days I'm going to be on that page. And, of course, the older one gets, the more one sees people dying around one's own age, and that makes it much more real. I think about it also partly because I believe as one gets older, one has to really say, what kind of a life do I want to live? How do I want to wrap my life up? When I look back on my life, what has that life been like? So it really, death is obviously a very final and fundamental measure of our life. And the question is, how do we approach that death? How do we think about it? And I suppose in retrospect, what will we make of our life once that moment comes?
What steps have you taken to put some controls, I guess, on the type of death that you want?
Well, like many others, I've signed an advance directive. I've specified what kind of treatment I do and do not want. And I've added one thing that most people don't add, and that is to say, if there is any uncertainty about the decision, then don't treat me. Frequently, people forget that most of medicine is uncertain, particularly in critical situations of life and death. And I think there's a kind of illusion, really, that when the final moment comes, a doctor will have a very clean, tidy decision to make, or a family will have such a decision. Unhappily, things are often gray and murky. And to me, the critical question is, what do you do when you are uncertain or your family's uncertain? And I think at that point, you have to decide in advance what you want done. My choice is, look, if there's doubt, let me go.
As a society, how would you say this country thinks about death, thinks about dying?
We are, I've decided, really an anomalous, strange, even odd country. Many European physicians and others who come here think that we believe death can be overcome if you simply throw enough money and science at it. We are much more likely than other countries to hide death, either through funeral services and funeral rites or memorial services, than is the case elsewhere. And I think in particular, we've invested a great deal of hope in medicine, that somehow medicine in the end is going to beat death and beat illness. And when this doesn't happen, we simply say, well, that's because we haven't really developed the good enough science to do it yet. And you just don't find this in other countries. Other countries, for whatever reason, they seem to be much more willing to face the reality and, in fact, to build the kind of rituals and culture to make death never totally acceptable, but at least tolerable and a part of life. We're a bizarre nation in that respect.
Would you say it's a kind of a frontier spirit gone awry, this sort of antagonistic view of anything that stands away in our future, this idea of manifest destiny, which is so much a part of the American culture?
That's certainly part of it. We're enormously optimistic as a country. I think the thing that strikes me when I often talk with Europeans about medicine, life or death, is Europeans, perhaps because of their war and their culture, perhaps because they don't have any further frontiers, they tend to be more pessimistic, a little more cynical about life in general. They don't entertain great vaulting hopes the way we do in this country. And that certainly expresses itself in our medicine, where we've been a leader in research throughout the world, and that's one sense, that's wonderful and it's good. Another sense, it bespeaks our kind of sense that my gosh, there's nothing that we cannot overcome if we would just work hard enough, including death, illness, aging, and disease.
Would you say that as a society that we have lost our ability to know how to behave around death? I'm thinking of a pretty common question people say when they hear about someone who's died. They say, "What do I say? What do I do? Do I call them? Do I come and visit?" The rituals don't seem to quite fit what has happened when someone dies.
I think that's exactly the case. I've noted in my own situation, family members or even a child, how awkward people felt and how important it was to find ways of putting, they came to help me, to put me at ease. I found that very often I had to help them. And even though I was in a situation of grief, it was, one couldn't help observing that people are simply awkward. We don't have a common language. We simply, somehow, by virtue of death being seen as such a tragedy, such an insult, we feel that there are no words that can adequately express what we feel or ought to feel, and sometimes people just don't have those words. Whereas, in fact, language is meant to sort of fill in the gaps. And even though it sounds trite to say it, I think there's a lot to be said for almost ritual, formalistic ways of responding in situations like that. It's nice to know that what you usually say is, and then you can say, "Well, I feel, we loved her. We're really sorry to see her go. We know how badly you feel." Trite, cliched statements, but it's precisely those kind of things that are sufficient and adequate for most purposes. We're not expected to be original in times of grief or mourning. We're not expected to say anything unusual, but we are expected to say something. And I think what is perfectly serviceable are very ordinary, standard kinds of things. But somehow we don't do that easily.
One of the things that you argue for in your book is to persuade Americans to start to create a common view of death. What is gained if we do that?
Well, first of all, it's going to be very difficult to gain a common view of death, but one thing we would gain would simply be that we find a way to talk with each other about death, and particularly talk with each other as strangers. I would hope that we would find ways to help each other go through the grieving process. We would find ways to sort of show people our affection for them, our understanding of the suffering they're going through, the sense of their loss, that we remove the kind of awkwardness from the subject, that we turn it much more into an event which is understood to be a part of life. And in that sense, we don't distance ourselves so much from death. I think everything begins in a funny way with talk. We have to learn to talk with each other. And then if we could create some additional symbols and rituals, that would help as well.
Is it possible to talk with the machines going in the background, if you know what I mean?
It's impossible to talk with machines going in the background. And indeed, when I think back, the early 70s, late 60s, when we first really began talking about these issues, the whole Death with Dignity movement came out of a feeling that life and death in the modern hospital were simply intolerable and inhumane and did indeed cut us off from people we loved at the time of death. Now, of course, we see a strong hospice movement in getting people out of hospitals to die, and most strikingly of late, a very strong efforts on the part of many to die at home to create a very different kind of atmosphere.
You would then support this idea of allowing or encouraging people to die at home?
I encourage
to facilitate the kind of conversations you're talking about?
I think so. First of all, you do set up the possibility of a much better interaction relationship between a person who is dying and family members, and that of course is crucial and fundamental. You also make it much more easier for neighbors and others to drop in and be a presence as well. Whether I would want to encourage it, in general, I would want to encourage it as a movement, but when you get down to individual cases, I think a great deal of delicacy is required. It's not easy sometimes for people to die at home. Families think that the idea is lovely, but the stress can be enormous. And while the technical problems might be managed, if this goes on for a long period of time, it can be very difficult. So people have to really ask themselves whether they're going to be up to this, whether the family members are going to have the kind of support they need to do this, and indeed to talk very carefully with the physicians about what the actual death is likely to be like.
My guest is Daniel Callahan, and he's an authority on ethics and medicine. He's written a number of books. The latest one is called The Troubled Dream of Life. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Daniel Callahan. His latest book is called The Troubled Dream of Life. Daniel Callahan is also the director and co-founder of the Hastings Center. Part of the problem with death, you say, is that with a lot of high technology treatments, we've created an existence that's something between life and death. Could you describe what that existence is?
Well, first of all, we are able to sustain life for a very long time these days. The process of dying can be strung out almost indefinitely by technology. And at the same time, of course, the quality of life of people living in that state can be very poor. So they're suspended somewhere between life and death. Moreover, there are some conditions, one of which persistent vegetative state, some used to be called irreversible coma, really sees people whose bodies are going, but their brains are long dead. And in that sense, they're in a kind of zombie-like state. There are thousands of people like that around as well. We've made, I believe, the whole process of dying a kind of fuzzy, gray technological event where we're not sure where life begins or death comes in. We don't know where the borderline is anymore. And, of course, for many doctors, it's harder and harder to really tell a family or tell a patient you're dying or not. There's always the hope we can try this, we can try that. Who knows? What strikes me looking historically at dying in the past is how quickly people died. Basically, you would get an infectious disease, typhoid, smallpox. If it was a plague, you would be sick for a few days. You would either die or you would get well. And if you got well, you were likely to be in perfectly fine health thereafter. Now people die much more slowly of chronic and degenerative disease, cancer, heart disease, stroke. Now, of course, we add AIDS to that. The whole process of dying is strung out, made much more difficult, and you can no longer really even say with any clarity that somebody is dying or not dying. You know in general they are, but if you're trying to make a prediction or even if you're the individual trying to figure out how much longer you have, it's very hard.
I'm wondering how for doctors and treating someone in this vegetative state, for them, what is the difference then between letting a patient die and hastening their death, whether it's withholding food or water, taking them off a respirator? How do they and how do you grapple with this middle area and the choices before physicians?
Well, let me say on the one hand, I am an opponent of euthanasia and an opponent of doctor-assisted suicide. On the other hand, I think doctors need to find it much easier to allow patients to die than is now the case. Doctors are trained to save life. Doctors are trained to use all the technology at their disposal. And doctors are also trained that when in doubt, treat. I believe we're going to have to change many of those attitudes. Doctors are really now tend to believe that if they stop treatment and a patient dies, that somehow they kill the patient. And often families, when asked, should we let the patient go, the families will say, I don't want to kill the patient by doing that. I don't want that machine turned off. I will feel like a murderer. I think that's a mistaken way of thinking. It's a bad psychology. The reality, ultimately, if people have a deadly disease, it's that the disease will kill them, not the turning off of a machine. But by virtue, I believe, of their training and the kind of technological cocoon in which modern medicine is practiced, there's a sense that, by God, if you're controlling this technology, if you stop it, you have been the executioner. That is a very heavy burden for doctors to bear.
Dr. Jack Kevorkian has helped a number of people die. People have sought his expertise. Mm-hmm. What issues does his work raise for you as a medical ethicist?
Well, of course, very fundamentally, it raises the questions of whether we want doctors in the business of helping people to take their own lives in the first place. Beyond that, it really raises to me the question, even if we should legitimate or legalize doctors assisting patients, could we in fact regulate it? My own guess is no matter what law we passed on, say, a physician's helping a patient to commit suicide, there would still be the Jack Kevorkians, because there will always be some people who will want what the law will not allow. I'm struck by the fact that many of the people that he's treated are people who are suffering some now, but they are not in extreme suffering. They really have turned to him to avoid future suffering rather than to be relieved of present suffering, and that's one of the worrisome features about what he does.
Is this, though, just the next step in people trying to control the end of their life, trying to control the suffering that they anticipate, being afraid that they're going to be kept alive against their own will?
It certainly, in one respect, looks like that. People are fearful of how they're going to die, and they're particularly fearful of what modern medicine might do to them. Of course, to me, I sort of turn that upside down and think it's sort of one of our perhaps great mistakes is that we have looked to medicine and medical technology to give us somehow a kind of ultimate control over life and death more generally. It's failed to do so. It can't help but fail to do so. And now we want to take the final step. I guess to me, the great mistake in the first place was expecting medicine to give us this kind of control. And the turn to euthanasia is simply going to kind of confirm what seemed to be a bad move in the first place.
But if part of what you're arguing for is a more public acceptance of death, a more common understanding of it, putting death rightfully in life and the discussions about life, what's wrong with a doctor, a good doctor, helping people die?
To me, I suppose there are a number of things wrong. First of all, I think it would make for a very fundamental change in the medical professions. Doctors would for the first time historically really take on the role of killing people or helping them kill themselves, which has been long forbidden, and I think forbidden in great part because of the very power of doctors. Doctors, by virtue of their technical skills, know how to kill very effectively. I think, to me, it would be a great social mistake to give doctors this extra power. I'm also, concerned with the fact that we live in a society which has never done a very good job with legalized killing. We allow killing now in the name of capital punishment, in the name of self-defense, and just warfare. we have made a terrible mess, it seems to me, of those other situations where we've legalized killing. And, of course, many of us are opposed to capital punishment. We see a gun crisis, which comes in great part out of a proclaimed right of self-defense. And of course, an awful lot of wars, perhaps most wars, may begin justly, but they end in unjust, terrible ways, usually. I hate to see a whole new category of killing added here, and particularly a killing superintended by doctors, whose role, it seems to me, should be to save life. I suppose, most people think, well, this is my private decision. I should be allowed to make this choice. I guess I see this as one of those private decisions that has enormous social implications. Somebody else's decision to have a doctor kill him or help him take his own life is going to affect my life and the life of everyone else, not just that individual.
How do you see your ideas about a greater acceptance and public understanding of death, how do you see that fitting into healthcare reform?
Well, part of the problem with healthcare reform in this country is precisely that people look to medicine to do, I believe, too much. I mean, we spend more on healthcare than any nation in the world, more in sheer numbers of the amount of money and more per capita. Part of this is that we have a wasteful, crazy, inefficient healthcare system, but part is because we really do look to medicine to do exceptional things with our lives. I think that even if we can have a more efficiently managed system, people will not be able to afford a kind of healthcare that wants infinite life, that expects to be medicine to rid them of all of their psychological and physical problems. The very high expectations are part of our problem. One of the reasons Europeans both have equitable healthcare systems, everybody gets access, but they spend a lot more money. And in great part, it's because people understand that you have to die. People understand that perhaps it's not in our common interest to spend $1 million to save an individual life when there are many other things we can do with that same amount of money to improve life in some other areas. I'm struck in general by the way the other countries manage to have a decent healthcare system, but always behind that is a much greater willingness to accept death and to understand that mortality is part of the human condition, and you just don't keep spending more and more money to fight that.
Daniel Callahan, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
Medical ethicist Daniel Callahan's new book is called The Troubled Dream of Life. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air.